This is the last week in English, summer semester 2019, week 8, with me, Mark Jacob, coming to you from the TU Berg Academy Freiberg. Today, for the first time, and hopefully not the last, we have an undergraduate student. Our guest is currently in the fourth semester of a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. Like most students, his interests are not just limited to the subject he's studying. And thanks to the English course he's taking right now, he was able to present one of his hobbies, or passions, I should say, to the class. We're going to find out today about world building. And here to tell us about it is Alrik Luda. Welcome, Alrik.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure for us. Before we get on to talking about the ins and outs of world building, could you first tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So, I'm 19 years old. I attended the Leipzig International School for 12 years and had the incredible privilege of speaking 8 hours of English a day. There has been a little downtime for the last 2 years, and my vocabulary is a bit rusty, but I think this podcast is just what it needs to get back in line.
Wow, you spent a lot of time speaking English. What is it then that made you decide to study mechanical engineering?
Well, to put it simple, I have a very, very wide range of interests, and all these subjects overlap somewhere. So in the big Venn diagram of all my interests, mechanical engineering was right in the middle, and Freiberg seemed like a suitable choice. Not only is the university very small, which is very nice because I get to know my professors and my tutors. It's not always good, because if you miss a lecture, Well, they might ask you where you were, but on the bright side, it's better than just being a number somewhere in, let's say, Munich, for example.
Right. So you chose Freiberg because it's cozy.
It's cozy. It's a familiar university with a nice atmosphere.
Yeah. How many students are there in the mechanical engineering in your semester, roughly?
We started off with 60 students 2 years ago, but we're down to 54.
Okay, well, that's not bad, 10%. Yeah, you mentioned that mechanical engineering is kind of in the center of all of your interests. One of your big interests, let's say, and this came out when you gave a presentation in the English course, is world building. Could you start by just explaining to us what that is?
The best point to start is probably to put down a definition first. So, the act of world building is creating an internally consistent fantasy setting, which is based on certain principles that the author, after having set them up, is not allowed to break. These worlds are, well, they can be found everywhere. They are found in literature, in movies, and in video games as well. Best example being literature. My favorite example there is Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. Absolutely lovely. For those who don't know what the Discworld series is, it's a setting where a flat Earth it looks like a pizza, to be fair, rests on the back of four elephants, which in turn stand on the great shell of a huge turtle just drifting through space. Someone can see a little satire going towards the flat earthers in there. Yeah. And Sir Terry Pratchett was a satirical genius, in my opinion. Very sad at his passing.
Yeah.
But he's left an incredible fortune of books, over 50 novels set in the Discworld, and much and many more. Okay, but I'm slightly deviating from what I wanted to talk about, which was world building in general. So there are two common approaches to world building. Some people define the top-down approach, where you start building a setting starting at the very largest object relevant to you, in most cases the universe. You start by defining the physical constants that govern the universe, should they differ from ours, and then you work yourself down. You go up to galaxies, well, you can usually skim over those, and then you go to solar systems, and this is where it gets complicated. You go into the planets, And these planets are what you spend most of your time on, because these planets and the conditions available to them define what type of life, and if at all, and what cultures, and thus what plots can evolve in your fantasy world. Then there's also the bottom-up approach, which is pretty much the opposite. You start with the smallest thing relevant to you, be it particle interactions if there are some deviations down there, and then you work yourself up. And you usually stop at the planet level as well, because the solar system, well, maybe you look at the solar system as well, because you want some lunar movements or some planets, some astrology in there for your cultures to look at and define and be defined by. But that's where you cut off as well. And then you sit down and decide, what kind of plot do I want in these worlds, and how can I make it possible? Because having set up your principles, violating against them is a big mistake you don't want to make when you present your world to your reader, or if you're a game developer, to your customers in the end, or as a movie producer, to the moviegoers in the cinema.
Can I just ask, what is your motivation? Is your motivation a world for a book, for a game, or for a movie?
Well, I started off with the... A book. Let's say that first.
Right.
I started off... I had a plot sparking in my head. I came up with one scene, then I came up with another scene. I had characters, they evolved. Then I had a couple more scenes at the end, and I noticed, these scenes are not the same plot. These scenes are not coherent, and the characters inside evolve as they want, and I have no control over them. I don't know what the world is like they're living in. I have no idea what motivates them and what drives them. I have no idea what countries lie beyond their own country, and what possible conflicts could arise from outside. I have no idea, does the planet have one moon? Does it have two moons? What are the tides like? Where is my city? Important thing. So I started doing some basic world building by just drawing a map, just adding, this is where the city is going to be. Here's a river, because cities tend to be along rivers for some reason. If you look at all historical civilizations, be it the Tigris, Euphrates in the Middle Eastern, or the River Tiber in Italy, that's where the big civilizations espoused, or the River Nile in ancient Egypt. So I sat down and started drawing a map, and at some point I was sitting in the living room of my 8-person flat. It's a wonderful thing with 7 other roommates in there. Very cozy. You get to know everyone very well. So I was sitting in the living room, just doodling around on my map, when suddenly a geologist popped up behind my shoulder and said, "Well, what is this you have there? This looks like Chile." "Like Chile?" I said. "No, not like Chile. It can't be Chile." When in the back of my head, I had the gears grinding, saying, but what if it were Chile? Because I didn't have a climate. I didn't know where this thing was set. Was it an ocean? Was it a Mediterranean? Was it somewhere on the globe? But after saying, well, this could be in Chile, I pulled up Google Maps, checked the coast of Chile, and said, yes, this definitely looks like Chile. It has to be Chile. And that adds another 2 features to my world building I didn't consider before. World building is incredibly interdisciplinary, and just by setting it in Chile, my city is prone to earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanoes. So that's something I have to consider when building the cultures as well.
Do you think, for example, with Terry Pratchett, did he take all these things into account when he was building his world?
I think Terry Pratchett had a different approach. In addition to the top-down and bottom-up, you can also talk about hard sciences and soft science approaches. Or the hard sciences typically being those associated with the natural sciences and maths. Basically anything where you can conduct empirical studies and no one will say, well, this looks a bit fishy. Whereas on the other hand, you have the soft sciences, which tend to be social sciences, sociology. This doesn't make them less important, it just makes them different. You have to approach them differently. And Terry Pratchett had a big... his works were... Some people would say almost entirely satirical, with a lot of aspects, at least. And he was able to transfer most of the cultures from our world into his world, and he mixed them together regardless of time period. So he had ancient Romans and Greeks existing next to each other, while you had an industrialized city on the other side of the continent. It's a very interesting mix, and you had Greek philosophers running around naked in the streets. Well, they weren't called Greeks, of course, but it was a bit obvious that he was going after Archimedes there. He was definitely doing a soft science approach, but by doing a soft science approach, he had a famous inventor, Leonard of Quirm, not to be mistaken for Leonardo da Vinci, who laid out some scientific principles for the world. Well, this is the speed of light. You can basically see it creep across the horizon. He was going into folklore a lot, and his world didn't need world building beyond the social part. And if he did, which is what some authors will probably do, or most authors, I think, he would have locked it away somewhere tightly, just to make sure this is something the reader will never see, because this doesn't add to my book in the way I want it to add to my book. And this is something, if I ever write a book, something I will do as well. I will lock it away somewhere in a cabinet, and the reader will be able to walk through the world, and it is my ambition that by merely observing what I have provided him, he should be able, or she, to deduce all the rules that govern this world.
You mentioned the hard and soft science, and that Terry Pratchett was more sort of soft science. What about in your world?
It's quite obvious, how should I say that? Just simply by studying mechanical engineering, and not by studying literature or drama or all of those wonderful arts, that I am going for a very hard scientific approach here. It will still be a book written in other subjects will be completely in layman's terms. Well, I hope mechanical engineering by the time I'm done here won't. But for example, geology, I won't have the time to go into the geology of my world in that great detail, so I will have to rely on the experts' opinions around me. So I'm basically in the perfect place to do that. There's no better place to ask geologists than Freiberg. And it was something that crystallized very early out of my writing. I started proper world building when I was back in grade 7. I had a good friend of mine sitting right next to me in the library. She was writing her story, I was writing my story. We didn't talk a lot to each other. Sometime later in grade 8, we actually talked to each other. We're just not just coexisting in the same space. And she gave me plot advice where I gave her technical advice. And that continued throughout my entire life, to the point that I started analyzing movies for... You can't call it flaws, because you're never provided enough information in the movies. But for inconsistencies that didn't make sense to me, that I tried to explain in some other with some other mechanism. It has to be an alternate universe. Magic is somehow involved, and I bet there are dragons somewhere, stuck at the bottom of a volcano. That's why they erupt. And whenever the dragon stirs, you have an earthquake.
In your world, then, focus is more on hard science.
Yes.
Yeah? And can you give some examples then of some hard science that's in your world?
The best example of hard science in my world is astronomy. I put a lot of time and effort into designing my solar system. Oh, and the timeline of my solar system, the creation of the solar system, so I can do some, say, funny things with the plot. I want the environment to dictate big events in my story, and one of those big events is the sudden appearance of a huge flaming object in the sky the size of, well, let's say the world there looks like Earth, and we have a moon like Earth, just to keep things simple. As my physics teacher, Mr. Dindorf, used to say, whenever you conduct an experiment, only change one thing, keep the rest the same. So keeping all of that the same and having our moon, I said, well, what if, just hypothetically, Earth were to get a second moon the size of our current moon, and how would they interact with one another? Well, as it turns out, moons this size are not very stable when you have two of them in an orbit around Earth. And that is what is going to drive the plot. Because at some point, this moon will crash down to the planet. And if it, or better, it will crash into the other moon, forming a ring of debris that will rain down as a meteor shower onto the Earth, and there will be a ring around the Earth that glows and sparkles, and it will mess with the tides. It will really mess with the tides and with the civilizations on top of the planet. I had to look for a real-world example of this. Are there any moons that are co-orbital? So what happens if you have two major moons on the same orbit? Well, they're bound to collide at some point. But I wanted to see if there were real world examples of this. And as it turns out, I think it was Saturn, because Saturn has the rings. Saturn has two tiny moons, which are actually co-orbital in a stable configuration. It's a very interesting thing. There's a nice diagram of it. You have two objects going round and round, and then one of them is a little bit closer to Jupiter, to Saturn, is a little bit faster, pulls the other one down, they switch places and go round and round and round, and they do this every 4 years. I thought about, well, I'll have the same thing, except because of the mass ratio of the planets to the planet to the moons, they won't be a stable configuration. So I looked at old statistical analysis of the early creation of our solar system and what happens to objects that are stationed at, they are called Lagrangian points in space-time, because I needed the moon to come from somewhere. I couldn't just make it appear. That's not how it works. Not if you're world building. You set on your principles and that's how you work them. So these Lagrangian points are basically wells or dips in space-time. They are positioned, well, two stable ones are positioned 30 degrees ahead and 30 degrees after the orbit of Earth. Anything parked there will be stable. That's grossly simplified. So I just parked a moon-sized object right in that place, saying that it was created there at the beginning of the solar system, and that a meteor impact set it off, and now it's drifting towards Earth as a huge flaming fireball to scare all the civilizations into accusing each other of having defied the gods and sparking conflict in the plot.
Right. Then you must have had to do quite a bit of research to find out all these things.
That's correct. But the good thing is that I wasn't alone. Many other authors have also started world building their books and novels, and it's been a very popular trope since the 50s when science fiction really took off. So you could argue science fiction and fantasy have more in common than any other tropes do, with the simple exception that science fiction is pointed ahead and the fantasy tends to look back, and there's a bit more of a social analysis of what's happening right now. And these authors have compiled multiple blogs, and the one I tend to go to over and over again is one by he was definitely a biologist. He studied the human genome. I'm talking about Dan Kobold, who has a huge compendium of real expert opinions on certain situations, everyday routines for nurses, on binary poisons, on so many hard science subjects that I almost miss that he has an entire subject of soft science subjects listed down as well. For example, how do magic schools work? What should magical academies look like? Or what are pupils taught in these magic academies?
Are we talking Harry Potter here?
We're talking Harry Potter here, yes, okay. Exactly.
Yeah, because I know there are a lot of Harry Potter fans out there. So what does he say then about Hogwarts?
It wasn't him, it was some it was a sociologist whose name I sadly didn't remember. She talked about, well, she asked a lot of questions, trying to figure out, is Hogwarts a trade school or is it a school for general education? And if it is a school, and if it isn't a trade school but a school for general education, what are the famous wizards and witches that these pupils learn about? Who are their idols and who are their magical pop stars? And that's nothing you... The soft science is usually more easily to build into the novel and the plot. So I would have wished that J.K. Rowling had put something in there. Not just a few teasers here and there. But I can't blame her for writing good books. It's and in my opinion, they're lacking here and there. But nonetheless, I enjoy the read and would read them again.
Yeah. Okay, so what about the soft science in your world or in your plot? What's behind that?
I started... I talked about my encyclopedia. That's a terrible word. Before, and it's split into two sections. Section one is called my favorite spice science, and the next section starts with the header lore, just general background information, and I adapted Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, which wasn't so brief after all. To describe a brief history of elves, dwarves, humans, a brief history of civilization and of states. Those are the main fantasy races that I just want to have in my world. For hard science reasons, they evolved. But I'm not going to spoil that here. Basically, the elves came first, then the dwarves came along, and then the humans came along, and their interaction dictates that certain people live in, are allowed or permitted in certain territories and others are not. You have the big trade cities, or generally the bigger the city, the more open the city. So you have dwarves, elves, and humans mixing and mingling in the big capitals. But as soon as you come to the rural, into the rural mountains, you will have human merchants maybe going into the villages but trying to evade them. So in terms of sociology, I focused on the historical relationships between these elves, dwarves, and human races and their tribes and their tribal behavior. For example, the elves tend to be rather long-lived. Okay, this is another thing dictated by their heart signs. They tend to be rather long-lived, and they are a very slow-evolving culture, and you can see them as one huge nation. So they have a big and very long collective memory. That goes over to the dwarves, which don't live as long, and they're a little more warlike, and they split into many clans, and they're spread all across... Well, the islands they live in and the continents they settle. They're a seafaring nation as well. They like the mountains and the sea. And they don't have an as long collective memory as well. They don't have an as long collective memory. There we go. And they tend to be impressed by brute strength. Whereas the elves go back for, well, I'm turning over every single word they have said. And the humans are the most short-lived and the most rapidly evolving culture here. They will generally... There's a sort of collective memory as we see it in our world as well, but they don't hold grudges as long, so they will be more open, and thus any plot set in the human world will be... it will be more dynamic. It will have to be quicker. And let's just compare politics in... human world and the elven world. Whereas in an elven novel, I would have probably have to set up this book or this plot over multiple millennia, and then detail every single thing that goes in between the huge, because everything's decisive for enough. You have a few major political decisions in the human world, which I can wrap up in a nice little plot ball, and then just have some side plots going in there as well, saying, okay, I have an upper class and a lower class, which I can, well, not like each other, to put it very basically. Have their social dynamics erupt into social tensions, have the rich say, well, we need more guards, how do we finance the guards? Well, more taxes, definitely. That always went well. And those can feed into the plot as well, just to make it more realistic as a setting.
Now, are the humans in your world, are they similar to us? Are they at a similar stage of development, let's say, an evolution?
Well, they're similar to us, as they have recently they went through a big war, so there's a huge anti-war sentiment there, but they haven't evolved as far as we have right now. They're stuck in the Victorian age, in the 1850s to 1900s, one could say, the steampunk age, essentially. Okay, this is where the author breaks with his world building, because you have some personal preferences, you want to get in there somewhere, and if you can get the steampunk down there, you start building all around and trying to say, well, what could possibly have happened that they didn't evolve into using petrol and other fossil fuels beside coal? So you start making stuff up. But you have to consult the geologist if it makes sense what you're making up. No, they are stuck in the Victorian age, as I said. They have an oligarchy that runs the big states, the one I'm focusing on right now, one state after another. But they will go through political turmoil, and over the next decade it will turn either into a monarchy or a dictatorship, depending on whether or not the current, well, villain, as I shall signify him now, claims a royal heritage or not.
Okay, but do you know how things are going to develop?
I have a rough idea where I'm going to go. Meaning, it's merely by logically thinking and by looking at past historical events, which I've had the great pleasure of studying extensively thanks to my history course, which I really regret taking. I should have taken something different. It didn't really help me there. basically the rise to power of dictators. That's what we looked at in the early 20th century. We looked at Stalin, at Hitler, and we looked at later on Fidel Castro. And they all had very different settings. Then how they used the political turmoil around them. Just from laying out these similar settings in my world, in the political environment, I can feel where it's going to go. But I'm probably going to be surprised as well where I end up.
Well, that sounds like a nice thing, that it might even surprise you.
It's a very nice thing with the characters as well, because unless you really want to set down a world and you want to set multiple stories in, this is the wonderful thing with short stories, you start out with some character and you possibly know their background, you know what they look like, but you haven't figured out any of their traits, of their abilities, and how are they compassionate? Well, maybe compassionate, if they have a family dynamic that is good, that is beneficial, that is abusive. And over the course of the book, you watch them evolve, and those are the best stories, in my opinion. Those where the author doesn't know where he wants to end it, because you feel that he doesn't have to stick to a word limit. He just spits in the book and says, next novel, here we go. So that's another interesting thing for authors to do as well. They can have some key plot points to work around, but in most cases no author will know what their characters will look like in 10 years time.
How many characters do you have?
Let me consult my encyclopedia. As laid out characters, I have a family of three with an unreliable fourth. He will be a very big plot propellant And then I have one, two, three ethereal beings. Let's just call them gods for simplicity. And multiple other side characters from the heavenly theater. And then there will be, well, the villain, obviously. And one of the gods has a very powerful sorcerer as a, what's called, as a butler, basically. Not a butler is the wrong word. As a, I can't seem to grasp it right now. Well, let's stick with evil butler helper thingy. I can share something about these characters if you...
Yep, please okay. Do.
Well, I have to go into a sort of disclaimer first because it's the same way people say you are what you eat, you also write what you read. So during my entire school career, big word there, I read books from predominantly from two authors. One being Brian Jakes, who wrote the Redwall series, anthropomorphized animals fighting for, peace in the end and to live a peaceful life in their castle, and then Terry Pratchett, whose books I've nearly all read, except for the one collector's edition book with Neil Gaiman, which I seem to have not been able to get my hands on yet. In his book, I was absolutely impressed by his portrayal of the Grim Reaper, whom he, I think, did he say he was the Grim Reaper or did he just call him Death? Well, let's just call him Death, small caps for now. And this portrayal of Death was so formative for me that I wanted this character as well, but I wanted him to behave differently, less philosophical, less cynical, more of a fun guy who's had too much work. And then I started finding him into the plot and deciding, well, who is he going to interact with? Because I can't have Death as my main character. He's not going to walk through the world a lot. Well, he's going to walk through the world a lot, but he's not going to experience it from the dynamic first-person perspective of a character I could have living in a thriving city. So I said, well, let's have another protagonist. Boy or girl, doesn't matter right here. So I flipped a coin and it turned out to be a girl. Fair enough. How is she going to interact with Death? Does she have a gift? Is everyone gifted? Or can people only see Death under certain circumstances, like in the moment they're dying, or in the moment they almost died? And they can go home and brag about how it was a chance of one in a million. I saw Death and I escaped, and Death probably pointed them the middle finger and said, I came here for nothing. Thank you. Okay, so this character went through a number of evolutions as well. First I thought, well, I have a big city. This can be compared to Victorian London, which means that I will have a lot of beggars and street children running around. They need to scavenge for food and money. So what if I set the first scene with a chariot accident, overturns, and the rich passengers die, the whole carriage flips, and suddenly there's a gaggle of street children roaming about and taking everything they can. And then Death comes there to obviously reap the souls of the fallen. And one of the girls just remains behind and looks at him, and Death looks at her as well, and they meet each other again over and over again in the book. That was my initial idea. It didn't work out like that. Another important character who's essentially responsible for the whole plot is I was inspired by the Greeks and the Romans copied from the Greeks. And the ancient Egyptian. No, wasn't it the Egyptians? I think we should cut that part. Another character that is very important and that essentially wrote the whole plot is the goddess of fate. She is the oldest goddess in the heavenly pantheon, and she literally writes the fates of the people in books. And as time goes by, these fates come true, and she stows them away in the library for other gods to read and as entertainment, just to stop them from meddling with her wonderful world. Because you can't have gods meddling in your world, they make things go wrong and icky. And for some reason, many gifted children are born after that. Who knows how that happened? Yeah. She used to be the most important goddess. Over time, well, she evolved right in the beginning. She was one of the first, well, you could say the first real god that evolved in this world as faith came to be and the people moved away from spiritual ancestors and let's say proto gods like the great boar who's protecting us all, and thank you for all the wild boars we have hunted. So people began to notice that once they prayed to this goddess or started to believe in her, she gained power, and vice versa. The people who believed in her lived longer. And simply by that mechanism, which is a self-propelling, well, wheel of fortune in this sense, the faith was able to spread and became the predominant faith of the whole world. And because everyone believes that the goddess of fate is dictating their fate, the goddess of fate gets to dictate their fate. So if everyone immediately stopped believing in that, she would lose all her power. But she's doing her very best to stop people from thinking that, because she can influence their thoughts as well. And the other gods are picking on her, because they really want to play with the world as well, but she's not letting them.
And these gods in your world, are they in the minds of the people, or do they have some kind of independent existence?
They have a real independent existence as well. They have, you can think of them, how's the best way? I explained this to a friend before. Think of these gods as incredibly powerful ghosts who live in an alternate dimension. They are as smart as the sum of their parts, meaning, and as powerful as the sum of their parts, meaning as powerful and as smart as all the people beneath them, as all their believers. You can think of it as crowd computing. And the more followers a god has, the more powerful he will be. And well, back in the old ages when the goddess of fate didn't say, "Stop meddling in my world," they would routinely just go to another village and just burn it to the ground, because that would boost their own number of believers relative to the other god whose village they just destroyed. Thus, they could ascend in the pantheon and have more power. And these gods, they evolve over time. They're not omnipotent. They haven't been around. Well, they're omnipotent to the degree that the humans can perceive it, but they don't have the answer to life. They didn't create the universe, which is another bigger question: who created the universe?
And is that part of your
That's
world
nothing I
building?
I could argue that the question exists outside the universe. Maybe I'll get to it at some point. Okay, so these gods, these powerful entities, who for simplicity's sake, I have called gods. They had physical manifestations as well. They walked on Earth. Think of the old myths of the Greeks and the Romans again, and that's essentially what happened, except it really happened. Not like those myths, that were just tales. They could be perceived as real accounts. I'm not going to be too creative there. I will take tales from ancient heroes, I will alter them, maybe give them a modern spin, and then I'll build them, and then I will weave them into the fabric of my universe as they fit. As someone clever once said, copying one book is stealing, copying many is research. Going by that, Maxime, I will go throughout. I have a whole world to play with, so I'm not limited to the Greek mythology. I can go into the Far Eastern ones as well, which I feel are a bit underrepresented in modern fan fiction. Modern no, fan fiction. I'm saying fan fiction already. You know, in modern fiction, best examples, well, best counter examples are. Rick Riordan's Percy Jackson series, which is entirely about the Greeks. Then Jason something was the Roman one, and then there are the Cain Chronicles about the Egyptian gods. Absolutely great, but I've kind of had those before in school. So trying to just educate myself and, if possible, my reader as well.
Right, who do you imagine your reader is?
I have absolutely no idea yet. So, if I look into the future where I want to go with this, then first of all, I want to finish my studies. Then I want to finish my encyclopedia so I know what world I'm dealing with in the first place. Then I will write a book, or I will finish writing the one I have started. To allow a reader to walk through the world and have a look around and hopefully have some fun as well. And after that, so with the book when it's written will be completely non-technical. It is supposed to have a popular appeal. I don't know if it will be young adult fiction. I've already done it on my characters are swearing quite a lot. I think it might be adult fiction. I'll see about that. I'm not writing a children's book. And then in the end, when I finish the book, I will go back to the encyclopedia and turn it into a textbook of sorts, a textbook of one and everything for me to go back to look at all the things I've learned and that I can relearn with this book. And because I'm studying mechanical engineering, I will fill it with case studies of mechanical engineering examples and diagrams and whatever I can find. And this is a dream for the very far future. Maybe I can hand this over to some student who's studying mechanical engineering in the States and say, "Here, check out this book. It's $10, not 600, like your usual textbooks. And it contains the very same things, plus a lot of fiction, and it's fun to read." I put a lot of effort into making it readable and understandable, which is another important thing about textbooks. Many textbooks are filled with knowledge, but it's hard to extract it. And I aspire to create one that is readable and has easily extractable information with some fun examples. Because the fun thing is what keeps my studies going. The fun thing is what drives any studies. If there's no joy, there's no reason in doing it.
Right. Oh, sounds like something we could do for the English courses, this sort of material, you know.
Material, for example.
No, for learning vocabulary
Oh,
and
yes, definitely. Some, I haven't. I've been thinking about expanding this encyclopedia about a section on grammar and spelling as well, because, well, coming from a German background, and having learned the German and the English grammar, I know that many things are very similar. But for example, quotation marks and how the punctuation inside the quotation marks is handled is completely different.
Right. And does language play a role in your world?
It will eventually when we come to it. I'm not J.R. I'm not Tolkien, so I won't build my world around the languages I've created. But those languages are absolutely essential. I have a rough timeline of how the languages evolve. There will be one main language. There will be many proto-languages, then the one main language is spread by the elves. As I said, they have a very low information entropy, you can call it. They don't lose the meaning of their words. Their language evolves very slowly. Oh, changes very slowly. It evolves very quickly when they have to find words for new things. And it will splinter over to the dwarves who will break it up And then these dwarves will transfer it to the humans, who will break it up even more, and possibly even invent their own languages. So that's the rough timeline of events I will go for.
Okay, but are you going to actually put some detail in there in the languages?
Maybe I'll hire someone.
Yeah, hire someone for that.
You can hire experts for conlanging, as it's called, online.
How much interaction have you had then with other people online when you're doing your world building?
It's been rather limited. It's been a one-way information highway thus
Right.
far. Mostly, I hardly believe that anyone out there actually knows I exist and what I'm doing right here. Well, I'm setting out to change that, definitely. But until then, I've registered in a couple of online sites that are, well, aim, that aim at world building. That there's a big online forum for is it cartography? I think so. But I've not posted anything yet, and I've just been around scouring through all the resources, being happy what I found.
Yeah, and have you met anyone in the real world, let's say, who also shares your interest in world building?
Yes, my roommate. Well, one of my roommates. He is a big pen and papers geek, and to learn more about my world, he had the wonderful idea of turning the setting into a pen and paper setting, meaning that I lay out a map and I provide them with enough information they need to create their characters, and then I have some rough historical events going on in the background in my mind, and then we have a sort of role-playing game where I am the game master, telling them what's going on, and they are the characters playing their individual lives and paths throughout the city.
Okay, so you've actually done that then, have you?
I'm
Oh, you're
working on
working
it
on it. You're
actively.
working on it.
Well, the map is finished, but neither of us have some time right now because the exams are coming up. And as much fun as this is, I have to focus on my studies as well.
Yeah. And you said once you finish your studies, you're going to work on more on this and on the book, or you're working parallel now, but
Yeah.
you want to finish things off after your studies. What about jobs then and earning money? And do you see yourself earning money with this, or are you going to become a mechanical engineer and
I will become a mechanical engineer first.
yeah.
I also chose mechanical engineering because it's a field of work I can imagine myself working in. I like solving problems. It's well, the easiest description there. But I'm considering, well, I've always liked physics, and I've always liked applied IT as well. So, and that's what the modern engineering looks like. You work with computers and you simulate things. I've worked with simulation programs before, had a lot of fun doing some 3D animations. It didn't work out very well. My characters tend to implode every time I started doing the scene. But okay, that's sidetracking again. No, I want to be a mechanical engineer, and I want to have worked in the field. It's my primary goal to collect as many experiences in as many fields of work as possible, and then possibly let them flow into the writing, to provide an accurate account of when, if I have an engineer in here, I have the incredible privilege of being an engineer myself and then writing an appropriate everyday life for this person. Or if I'm also considering working as a emergency worker for the hospital at some point, and doing a gap year and just having a, what's it called, a program to learn to work as a medic, just so I can get a glimpse into this world as well and have some valuable skills for later life. And I'm considering to go into thermofluid dynamics in the near future. Possibly this could lead me into my, oh, favorite country here on Earth, Iceland. They are very big in geothermal energies.
Okay, yeah. And would you
and if
like to go there as part of your studies?
I would very much like to go there as part of my studies. I don't know how the cooperation with the Icelandic University in Reykjavik looks like. I've only been on their site and tried to look around a bit, but didn't find much. And if I can get a bachelor's thesis there, I would be so happy. That would be absolutely great. And I guess if everything works out as I think it will work out, then I will work as a mechanical engineer for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and work on the book while doing so, and then knock it out. And if I'm lucky, I can use it to finance my pension.
But it seems like it's very rewarding in itself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The entire field of world building is very rewarding to the person who world builds. You need a bit of curiosity to set things going, but anyone who's ever clicked on a Wikipedia link and then clicked on another and another and another and another and suddenly was 3 in the morning is probably a viable world builder. how best put it? If you world build, something my German teacher said, before you break the rules, you have to know them. And you can't build a world fantasy setting and bend the rules if you don't know what the rules are. You end up making up some stupid rules, like, okay, this doesn't have to be stupid, but in my world it would be stupid, like raining from bottom up. That's pretty useless. You end up with all your water off the planet and somewhere in space. Great. Great for life. They will be so happy. So much more land to work with. No, but yeah, you have to know the world and the rules of your real world before you start making your own.
Right.
I learned so much about astronomy and about chemistry and about physics. I looked into quantum mechanics, which are my respect to all people who understand that. it was a fun read. And you can do some quite messy stuff down there, but just adding, one of my first ideas was to just add a fancy little extra particle here, another particle there. What kind of particle will it be? Will it be a hadron, a baryon? Will it be a boson, a meson? And maybe I can use this particle to explain the magic in my world and how it works.
Well, it sounds like you've still got so much more to say about world building. You're going to have to come back for another podcast, Arik.
And I'd love to come back. And to anyone listening, feel free to leave a comment under the podcast if you've ever engaged in world building and want to share your experiences.
Yeah, or if you have any comment about what Arik's been talking about today. So thanks again, Arik.
Thanks for having me.